content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support. Today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the November 23rd, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is set on the front lawn of the White House. In the background, behind a tree, you see Donald Trump peeking out from behind a tree. And in the foreground is Matt Whitaker, the acting attorney general since Jeff Sessions' resignation. He's dressed in all black. He's got his fists clenched and a stern look on his face. And he's holding by a chain a bulldog with a studded leash, collar, and a fierce look, a growl. And the headline is Trump's New Protector. Will Whitaker scutter Mueller's investigation? And we will go into the two short main stories. We'll get back to that cover story in the controversy of the week. But we'll start with finger pointing as wildfires ravage California. What happened? The most destructive wildfire in state history tore through Northern California this week, killing at least 48 people and destroying more than 6,500 residences, while another blaze left two dead in Southern California and had burned nearly 100,000 acres when the week went to press. The campfire demolished the town of Paradise, 145 miles north of San Francisco, within hours, and hundreds of residents remained missing days later. Thousands of responders struggled to contain the fire, which at one point jumped 140 feet across a seven-lane freeway. In Ventura and Los Angeles counties, the Woolsey Fire lapped at the borders of L.A., destroying 435 structures and spreading devastation from mobile home parks on the fringes of the city to glittering celebrity-owned mansions in the Malibu area. More than 300,000 Californians were evacuated as people throughout the state were warned of dangerously smoky air. President Trump approved federal funding for disaster relief, though days earlier he blamed California politicians for enabling the crisis. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests, he wrote on Twitter. The latest outbreak continues a devastating year for California, where fire season is now year-round. At least 105 Californians have died in wildfires in the past 2 years, more than in the entire previous decade. This year, upwards of 5,600 fires have burned 2,100-plus square miles. In Paradise, County Sheriff and Coroner Corey Honea warned that even after evacuees return, it's possible that human remains can be found. What the columnist said, "Fires are relentless in punishing our mistakes," said Silas Lyons in USA Today. "Wildfires occur naturally, but California's short-sighted policies created a public health catastrophe. For years, the state put out small fires, letting vegetation build up that now fuels uncontainable blazes. Despite this, said Stephen Pine in Slate.com, developers erected towns in the fire equivalent of floodplains. While surviving Paradise residents lost their entire town and Malibu residents fled for their lives, said the Sacramento Bee in an editorial, the president turned yet another national disaster into a political sideshow. No, Mr. President, the state's forest management didn't cause these fires. The campfire started near Plumas National Forest, which, like 60% of California's forests, is not managed by the state. while the Woolsey fire began nowhere near a forest. Trump's scolding acts as accelerant on the broken hearts of our burning state. Abandoned buses, charred streets, one empty home after another, said David Wallace Wells in NYMag.com. Were we watching the news or the zombie apocalypse? Scenes from California were almost too harrowing to believe. When it comes to climate horrors, the real world is already outpacing our imaginations. I worked as a firefighter in Washington State, says Anastasia Selby in Vox.com, and people in that field are especially attuned to the ways climate change puts us at risk. It will only get more dangerous as rising temperatures and extended droughts create the perfect conditions for ignition. And a second main story, Trump spars with allies on European trip. What happened? President Trump stood increasingly isolated on the world stage this week after an acrimonious trip to France to mark the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Almost immediately upon landing, Trump tussled with French President Emmanuel Macron, tweeting that his plan for a European army was very insulting. He had seemingly been angered by a garbled press translation, which said Macron wanted a European army as protection against the U.S. Macron had in fact said such a force would reduce Europe's reliance on U.S. defense help. The next morning, Trump scrapped a plan to visit a cemetery for American war dead, with the White House blaming poor weather for grounding his helicopter. "I suggested driving," Trump tweeted later, but the Secret Service said no. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly did attend the ceremony at the site of a battle in which 1,800 Americans died. Macron and German Chancellor Angela Merkel paid their respects to the war dead under gray skies at another ceremony the same day. Later in the trip, Trump sat stonily as Macron delivered a rebuke of his America First politics. In a speech, Macron branded nationalism a betrayal of patriotism and warned against old demons coming back to wreak chaos and death. Trump blasted Macron with a series of incendiary tweets, mocking his low approval rating and even the Nazi occupation of France. How did that work out for France? They were starting to learn German in Paris before the U.S. came along, Trump wrote. What the columnist said. The crumbling of America's alliance with Europe couldn't have been any clearer in Paris, said Robin Wright in NewYorker.com. As European leaders marched together in the rain toward the Arc de Triomphe on Armistice Day, Trump chose the dry comfort of his limousine. Russian President Vladimir Putin was the only leader that the president seemed to connect with. Putin also arrived at the ceremony alone and gave Trump a thumbs up. Trump showed contempt for America's service members by skipping the memorial at Ansmann American Cemetery, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Instead, he holed up at the U.S. ambassador's residence. This is par for the course. He still has not visited U.S. troops deployed to a war zone and is now using troops as political props at the Mexican border. That's not to say he didn't sacrifice anything by skipping the ceremony. Odds are that his room didn't have Fox News. Macron chose an odd occasion to lecture an American president, said Steve Cortez in RealClearPolitics.com. It was American nationalism that animated our mighty republic to save Europe. Not once, but twice. Religious liberty, pluralism, free enterprise economics, respect for our Constitution, and reverence for our great flag define America's enlightened nationalism. Conflating it with Nazi ethnofascism misses the mark. When such ideals were endangered in Europe, we demonstrated our historic commitment to defending them by fighting overseas. controversy of the week, referencing back to the cover drawing, Whitaker, fit to serve as Attorney General. Sorry, but there is no way this man should be running the Justice Department, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Within hours of last week's midterm elections, President Trump forced the resignation of Attorney General Jeff Sessions and appointed Matt Whitaker, Sessions' chief of staff, to fill the position temporarily. To call Whitaker a Trump loyalist is a wild understatement. The weightlifting former college football player is an arch-conservative who charmed his way into the White House with a string of cable news appearances in which he scoffed at Russian election interference, dismissed the very idea that a president can obstruct justice, and mused aloud about ways that a new attorney general might defund special counsel Robert Mueller's probe so that it grinds to almost a halt. Trump and his family have a direct, concrete interest in the outcome of Mueller's investigation, said Neil Katyal in WashingtonPost.com. The idea that the president could install an unqualified lackey to interfere with it is fundamentally at odds with the most cardinal principle that no one is above the law. Whitaker's appointment is also unconstitutional. A specific congressional statute, the Attorney General Succession Act, requires the AG's deputy, in this case, Rod Rosenstein, to be his or her replacement until a new nominee is confirmed. Trump's illegal installation of Whitaker must be stopped. Whitaker may be a bad choice for Attorney General, but he's a legal one, said Stephen Vladek in the New York Times. The Federal Vacancies Reform Act explicitly allows officers not confirmed by the Senate to serve if their term is less than 210 days. Besides, the pearl-clutching over Whitaker's appointment is based on a deliberate misinterpretation of his previous public comments, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. What he actually said was that the Mueller investigation should stay within the bounds originally established, to determine if there was any U.S. cooperation with Russia's attempt to interfere in the election. Let's give Whitaker a chance to do his job. Whitaker is worse than a partisan hack, said Aaron Dunn in WashingtonExaminer.com. He might be better labeled a scammer. Before joining the Trump administration, Whitaker sat on the advisory board of World Patent Marketing, a Florida firm that charged inventors millions of dollars for non-existent marketing services. Whitaker wrote to unhappy customers, identifying himself as a former U.S. attorney and warning of serious civil and criminal consequences if they complained publicly about the ripoffs. Trump hired this partisan pit bull for one reason, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. The president has repeatedly stated that he views the attorney general as his lawyer, whose primary job is to protect him, and he obviously expects Whitaker to do what Sessions wouldn't, shut the Russia investigation down. That makes Whitaker's appointment the most dire threat to the republic since Trump's election itself. Whitaker is no fool, said David French in NationalReview.com. Although firing Mueller might delight Trump's base, it would alarm the broader American public and add serious weight to the case for impeaching Trump for obstruction of justice. Whitaker isn't going to take any actions that would trigger a political and constitutional crisis. Mueller's probe is reportedly nearing completion, said Benjamin Witz in TheAtlantic.com. So even if Whitaker did fire Mueller, House Democrats would simply invite him in January to share his findings in a public hearing. If Trump really did appoint Whitaker to protect him from Mueller, it's probably too late. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems that it was a good week for lungs, with the news that fewer Americans now smoke cigarettes than at any point since record keeping on the issue began. Only 14% of adults reported smoking in 2017, down from 15.5% the year before and 42.4% in 1965. It was a good week for onboard services after a Philippine Airlines flight attendant breastfed the screaming child of a passenger who had run out of bottled formula. With a nine-month-old of her own at home, flight attendant Patricia Organo said she realized there was only one thing she could offer the distraught baby, and that's my own milk. It was a good week for millennials, who now had their own special edition of Monopoly, the iconic board game. Monopoly for millennials has players invest not in houses and hotels, but in super relatable experiences, such as a trip to a vegan restaurant or a three-day musical festival. But it was a bad week for tourists, with news of a herpes B epidemic among the macaque monkeys of Silver Springs State Park in Florida. The potentially fatal disease can be spread through feces, which monkeys have been known to fling at visitors. It's a bad week for Darren from accounts, with a new survey showing that 35% of companies won't hold office holiday parties this year, largely to avoid potential liability following the Me Too movement. And finally, it was a bad week for taking personal responsibility after Chicago Bears kicker Cody Parkey blamed God for the fact that he missed two field goals and two extra points during this week's game. My Lord and Savior Jesus Christ makes no mistakes, Parkey said. For whatever reason, that was the day I was supposed to have. And before we move on, a short piece. Tech glitches impede a promise to veterans. Hundreds of thousands of veterans haven't received housing and education benefits due to bureaucratic tech failures, NBCNews.com reported this week. This is, to be kind, a train wreck, said Representative Phil Rowe, Republican from Tennessee, chairman of the House Committee on Veterans Affairs. Last year's Forever GI Bill expanded benefits for veterans and their families, but did not provide for upgrades to the VA's Office of Information Technology. The system has been nightmarishly slow processing requests for housing allowances required under the revised law, and more than 82,000 students had yet to receive housing stipends, with only 2 weeks remaining in the school semester. Before the Forever GI Bill was passed, a VA official told Congress, "My biggest concern is two words, IT." And we'll move on to the briefing page. The title this week, Self-Driving Cars, Not So Fast. The driverless car revolution is way behind schedule. Is it still just a matter of time? What's gone wrong? Car makers have been claiming that autonomous vehicles, or AVs, will start filling the roads by 2020 and take over by 2030. Instead, AVs are pumping the brakes as their futuristic technology has faltered in the unpredictable chaos of real-world roads. The rollout of General Motors' self-driving car subsidiary, Cruise Automation, is years behind schedule, and prototypes by Ford, Tesla, and the Google affiliate Waymo would still flunk driver's ed. AVs sometimes react to parked cars as if they're moving, and they get overwhelmed passing through construction zones. They're shaky at challenging maneuvers like turning left against oncoming traffic. Americans remain deeply skeptical about their safety. In March, an Uber-owned AV going 40 miles per hour in Tempe, Arizona, fatally struck a 49-year-old pedestrian crossing the street in the dark when the vehicle's perception system got confused by the bicycle she was wheeling. Uber suspended testing nationwide. General Motors President Dan Ammann calls developing AVs that can navigate through urban traffic the engineering challenge of our generation. Klaus Fröhlich, BMW's head of research and development, puts it more candidly. Everyone in the industry is becoming more and more nervous that they will waste billions of dollars. What are the design obstacles? Most AV developers, including Uber and Waymo, equip their cars with LIDAR, L-I-D-A-R, that's light detection and ranging sensors that use rapid light pulses to map a vehicle's surroundings in 360 degrees. Many AVs are also equipped with cameras, radar, and GPS antennas to take in information. But even the most advanced technology has performed inconsistently on the road. LIDAR falters in heavy rain and snow, and it struggles to detect the little plastic bumps that are sometimes used to divide lanes in California and other states. We're not even remotely close to being able to be truly autonomous in diverse conditions, said Austin Russell, CEO of LIDAR manufacturer Luminar. Motorists rely on human cues that technology cannot detect, the gestures of a traffic cop, or eye contact with a pedestrian or another driver that can help us predict their behavior. Engineers, however, believe AVs can use their experience on the road to refine their programming through machine learning. How's testing going? Reasonably well, when roads are not too congested. There have been more than 100 accidents involving AVs, though most were minor and caused by other cars or pedestrians. Waymo has tested about 600 cars in 25 cities and has run computer simulations for 7 billion miles of driving. A lot of AV testing occurs around Silicon Valley. In the Phoenix area, where wide, flat roads invite testing, Waymo gives rides to about 400 households through an app. Washington, D.C. will allow AVs early next year, as long as each has a safety driver and a secondary engineer. Arlington, Texas installed driverless shuttles on closed roads, mostly to transport people between parking lots and sports stadiums. And the roughly 1,500 rides to date have been successful. Yet a nationwide AV rollout would require consistent regulations. For now, rules vary from state to state. Can AVs ever be safe? Developers think AVs are certain to be dramatically safer than human-operated cars. Computers, after all, don't drive drunk, distract themselves by texting, or succumb to road rage. There were more than 40,000 traffic-related deaths in the U.S. in 2017, and researchers say 94% of car accidents are caused by human error. Yet surveys consistently find that only about a quarter of Americans would feel safe riding without a driver. Beyond tech challenges, programmers must confront many ethical problems. Should a car whose brakes fail crash into five people in a crosswalk, or veer off the road and hit one person on the sidewalk instead? Should the car stop short for an animal in the road, even if doing so would endanger humans in that vehicle and in other cars? Before we allow our cars to make ethical decisions, MIT researchers recently concluded, we need to have a global conversation to express our preferences to the companies that will design moral algorithms. Will AVs ever rule the road? Despite the setbacks, carmakers continue to set ambitious goals, and they predict that the mass introduction of AVs will be as transformative as the introduction of the automobile itself. But even if design flaws are fixed, there will still be countless issues to address. Car insurance will need to be entirely reworked. Traffic laws will also require an overhaul. It's unclear whether the ubiquity of AVs would lead to a surge in cars on the road, which could be a pollution disaster. And computerizing transportation invites all sorts of cybersecurity dangers, as a car's controls could be hacked and its movements easily monitored. But the greatest obstacle of all, engineers agree, is the fear people will have of trusting a robot to drive through traffic. Andrew Moore, the head of computer science at Carnegie Mellon University, says the self-driving car will not become popular until there's proof that it's much safer, like a factor of 100 safer, than having a human driver. We'll move into a few of the best columns of the week. The first is titled, Scaring Off Election Hackers. The Russians did not mount a serious cyber attack on our midterm election, said Eli Lake, and it's likely because U.S. cyber warriors have gone on offense. The Department of Homeland Security feared that Russia, China, Iran, or North Korea might infiltrate voting databases and even change election results. So the Trump administration launched a program in September to unleash U.S. Cyber Command to hack the hackers back. When trolls and military hackers probed our networks, U.S. cyber warriors sent them pop-ups, emails, texts, and direct messages warning them that they would pay a steep price if they tried to disrupt the midterms. U.S. officials say there is much more going on that remains classified, but the goal is to force adversaries to devote resources to securing their own networks. This shift has been a long time coming. In 2016, the Obama administration did little in response to Russian hacking, fearing an escalation of the cyber war. But the U.S. can't sit around waiting to be attacked, and this time, deterrence worked. Will that be true next time? Nobody knows. Though we can't see the fighting, the Internet is becoming the international battleground of the 21st century. This column comes from the United Kingdom. The EU's one-size-fits-all is bound to fail. Is the European Union doomed to decline and fall like the Soviet Union? Asked Jeremy Warner. It's easy to dismiss such predictions as wishful thinking by pathologically Euroskeptic commentators. But there are plenty of similarities between today's EU and the pre-collapse USSR. At the height of its power in the 1960s, the Soviet Union seemed indestructible. The superpower's spectacular decline came about because its leaders were unwilling to adapt their fixed system to growing economic challenges. They didn't see any need for serious reform until the 1980s, but by then it was too late. Sound familiar? The euro is, in a sense, Europe's very own version of the calamities of the Soviet Union's centrally planned economy. This one-size-fits-all system is utterly incapable of adapting to national needs and priorities. Is it any wonder, for example, that Italy recently voted in a government of anti-EU clowns, given that its GDP has barely risen since it adopted the single currency 20 years ago? Yet Brussels continues to deny that the fault lies in its unyielding approach. It always blames local failures. What we learn from the USSR's experiment in top-down political rule is that when political systems collapse, they do so at frightening speed. If EU leaders don't heed that lesson, then Euston, we have a problem. And this from Egypt. Letting Christians die in terror. when Islamist terrorists murdered seven Coptic Christian pilgrims in the European desert earlier this month. The world knew exactly who was to blame, said Michael Ekladios, the victims. Egyptian officials praised the military for its success battling jihadist insurgents and insisted the pilgrims would not have been attacked if they'd stayed on roads with security checkpoints. Meanwhile, the international media suggested the Copts were targeted not because they are a long-persecuted Christian minority in a majority Muslim country, but because they all support President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in return for a degree of protection. Never mind that el-Sisi's government routinely discriminates against Copts. Fewer than 1% of Coptic churches and other religious buildings submitted for approval in early 2017 have been accepted, or that his military regime has utterly failed to safeguard the Copts. 19 months before this latest attack, 28 Christians were killed on their way to the very same monastery the pilgrims were visiting. What Copts and all Egyptians need is not a strongman president touting the language of protection. This country needs a government that can provide poor and uneducated communities who are most susceptible to jihadist propaganda with schools, jobs, and infrastructure. Stop blaming the victim. These atrocities do not happen in a vacuum. And now the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Tony Stewart's Culture War. As NASCAR's audience loses interest in the sanitized sport, said Rachel Corbett, an ex-NASCAR star packs in crowds for dirt racing, the circuit's crude, dangerous, anti-PC challenger. The air was heavy with exhaust and motor oil at Charlotte Motor Speedway in North Carolina as I waited for Tony Stewart to arrive. Charlotte was hosting the 2017 championship weekend for the World of Outlaws, the premier dirt racing series in the country, and all 60,000 tickets had sold out well in advance. Stewart, the ex-NASCAR star, was late, running on Tony time, a handler told me. So I went for a walk along the dusty pit road to look at the scores of race cars lined up. You'll probably have to run at some point, I was warned. And remember, the cars can't turn right. Their larger right side tires help them around the loop that only bends left, and indeed make it nearly impossible to turn right. The crowd was young and middle-aged, mostly male and almost entirely white. There were lots of graying goatees and wraparound sunglasses and T-shirts that read, grabbing gears, drinking beers, slapping rears, and God made, Jesus saved, racetrack raised. Until recently, NASCAR distanced itself from dirt track racing. It was a holdover from the sport's southern past and emblematic of the backwoods image it has spent decades trying to shed. But today, dirt racing is to NASCAR a little like mixed martial arts is to boxing, a rough-edged insurgent counterculture that's proud of the pain it deals out. On dirt, the ovals are short, often a half mile around, about a quarter the size of most asphalt tracks, which means cars cluster nose to tail, nicking and bumping one another off the road. The track can be muddy, river bottom gumbo of the south or the red dust of the southeast, and it changes with the weather, causing unpredictable slides and skids. It's common to see crashes, fires, or sometimes a car flip over the fence into a cornfield. Stewart finally arrived at the World of Outlaws race around 4:30, looking unusually fashionable in dark fitted jeans and an RVCA t-shirt. 2.5 years ago, he started dating a former Playboy playmate named Penelope Jimenez, and he explained he took a seat on the leather couch in his trailer. About 80% of the clothes that were in my closet got banished. While he went to change into his black Arctic Cat fire suit, Jimenez lent me a pair of plastic safety glasses and a baseball cap to shield against the spraying dirt. She poured us 2 paper cups of red wine, and we went to watch from a pair of folding chairs near turn 2. The race began at sundown with a prayer for the military and for the safety of drivers and track workers. Not an idle concern at a dirt race. NASCAR hasn't had a fatality in any of its upper levels since Dale Earnhardt's nationally televised death in 2001, which led it to impose strict safety regulations. But short tracks, which host the dirt races Stewart prefers, are often lethal. 2/3 of all racing deaths occur on them, with drivers often competing for awards of $1,000 or less. In 2014, the Charlotte Observer reported that over the previous 25 years, at least 171 people had been killed at dirt tracks. NASCAR's transformation from a southern pastime to a regulated global business has unleashed a familiar feeling culture war within its ranks, between the southerners and the coastal elites, those who came up on dirt tracks and those who came up on pavement. Racing forums today are filled with complaints about how boring it is to watch millionaires turn left and be polite to one another. Television viewership of the Daytona 500, one of NASCAR's most important races, is down 45% from 2005. The Championship Cup race in 2017 was the lowest rated in the series history. Many of NASCAR's disaffected fans have been flocking to dirt tracks like the one in Charlotte and the one Stewart owns in Ohio, Eldora Speedway. Stewart has become a serious investor in dirt racing. In recent years, he has bought 2 dirt racing teams, a regional series, a dirt car manufacturer, and a stake in 2 other dirt speedways in Kentucky and Illinois. He drives in about 70 dirt races a year. Where NASCAR has lost its emotional resonance with fans, Stewart has handily harnessed it. Stewart grew up in auto racing country. Cars in the area were plastered with bumper stickers for Dale Earnhardt and Jeff Gordon. Family outings took place at the nearby Indianapolis Motor Speedway, home of the Indy 500. Tony won a national go-kart competition at age 12, soon graduated to sprint cars, and later earned the nickname Smoke because of the way his tires burned rubber on turns. Tony was a wild teenager, drinking and crashing family cars. At 18, his mom kicked him out of the house, and he took jobs at McDonald's and a concrete block plant, racing on the side. In 1993, he won 2nd place at a race in Arizona and was awarded $3,500, far more cash than he saw at his day jobs. In 1994, a NASCAR team owner approached Stewart at a dirt race in Ohio and offered him a part-time position in the Busch Series, now the Xfinity Series, the 2nd highest tier in national racing. Stewart proved himself there and in 1999 was recruited to race in NASCAR's Winston Cup, the top tier of American racing. Stewart and his number 14 Chevrolet would win 3 Cup races that year, followed by championships in 2002, 2005, and 2011. His talent won him notice, but his hot-headed swagger, a throwback to the sport's rowdier days, made him a superstar. Still, no matter how much Stewart excelled in NASCAR, he could never quite leave his past behind. He refused to stop running dirt races, even after shattering his leg in 2013 crash that caused him to miss 15 NASCAR events. 3 years later, he fractured a vertebra in an off-season accident and missed an additional 8 races. I think if he could have retired 10 years ago from NASCAR, he would have, the NASCAR driver Kyle Larson says. He was making a living there so he could play in the dirt. The sprint cars that Tony Stewart drives are the fastest, most dangerous models in dirt racing. Their 360 cubic inch iron block V8 engines can generate 800 horsepower with speeds of up to 150 miles per hour. With an open cockpit and an uneven pair of rear wheels that sit outside a stripped down frame, they look like something out of Mad Max. Because of the staggered wheels, steering is more difficult in sprints. The car's natural inclination is to turn left, which means drivers sometimes have to hit the throttle and pull a hard right just to go straight. Expert car control is even more essential on dirt, where the track changes throughout the night. The groove on the outside or top of the track is generally considered the fastest. It's also where, by the end of the race, the dirt tends to get pushed up and hardened into a steep angle known as the cushion. Hit the cushion too fast, and it could send you into the wall. Instead, to pass a car on the top part of the track, a skilled driver may use a technique known as a slide job. When a car on the inside track intentionally turns into a corner too sharply, causing it to skid to the top with, ideally, enough momentum to slide just in front of the other car. That's the move Stewart tried on August 9, 2014. That night, Stewart, still a star in NASCAR, arrived at the Canandaigua Motorsports Park in upstate New York for a dirt race in the Empire Super Sprint Series. 14 laps in, Stewart, trying to pass, slid into Kevin Ward Jr.'s car on the turn, edging him off the track. Ward hit a wall and spun around. He climbed out of the car unscathed but angry. He stomped onto the track, pointing towards Stewart's car. The stakes were much higher that night for Ward, who was 20, than they were for Stewart. Ward had dreamed of joining NASCAR since he was a boy, but racing Stewart that night would bring Ward as close to NASCAR as he would ever get. The yellow flag flew, signaling that cars should slow down. Drivers passed Ward as he stood there, still pointing at Stewart. Then, just as Stewart reached Ward, he sped up and fishtailed, the right rear wheel hitting Ward and pulling him underneath. Stewart's car dragged Ward for a few seconds before flinging him 50 yards down the track. An ambulance rushed the young man to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Stewart refused to say anything to me about Ward's death, but he has maintained publicly that he didn't see him until it was too late. The racing community is divided. Stewart's fans call it an accident, while others point to his infamous temper as evidence of malice. Everyone agrees that Ward should not have exited his car on a hot track. To this day, any mention of Stewart on the internet draws comments alternately accusing him of getting away with murder or defending him from character assassination. The year of Kevin Ward's death was Stewart's worst ever in NASCAR. The following season wasn't much better, and in 2016, he quit for good. I went to see Stewart again in June at his Eldora Speedway, about an hour northwest of Dayton. Stewart is proud of the Speedway, which he bought in 2004, and has been gradually renovating since. He gave me a tour, starting with the bathrooms, showing how he has upgraded the men's troughs to urinals. Light sconces now adorn the women's rooms, and he put coat hooks in the stalls. You go to any dirt track in the country, and they don't have those, he says. The concessions look like typical race fare to me, corn dogs, chicken fingers, fries, but Stewart swore that some of it is better than fast food. Behind the concession area is the grandstand and Stewart's favorite seat in the house. He sat down on a wooden bench looking directly over the start-finish line. It gives me chills every time, he said. The finish line is also where he tells drivers to go if they want to fight. Often drivers have it out in the pits, but, Stewart said, the crowd paid for the show. Later that night at the race, Stewart placed badly in the heat, 7th. But around 11:30 p.m., he still had half an hour's worth of autographs to sign. Toward the end, a woman approached him with a little container in her hand. It held her mother's ashes, she told him, and she wanted to spread them on the track. When I asked about it later, he shrugged. Happens all the time, he said. Eldora's general manager was standing next to him and nodded. 8 or 9 times a year, to be exact. By midnight, all the rigs had hauled out. Jimenez sat in the back seat of the truck, thumbing her phone. Stewart, leaning back in his seat, steered with one hand out toward the parking lot, then stopped. Want to take a lap around the track? He drove the truck out onto the dirt, hardened and rutted from the race. He clung to the oval's outer edge, the side of my face just a hair from the wall, and explained how the dirt changes over the course of a race, shifting from the inside to the outside. By the end of the race, the dirt has no place to go, and it gets that really steep angle. You make a mistake running fast, and you're running into a wall. When we finished the round, he glanced at the exit, at the black night on the other side of the fence. Actually, let's make it a few laps. He returned his gaze to the stadium-lit track, emptied of night, emptied of the unknown, hit the gas, and lurched again toward the finish line. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. We'll read one of the obituaries this week. The comic book titan who made superheroes human. Stan Lee, 1922 to 2018. In 1961, Stan Lee tore up the comics rulebook. A writer at Marvel Comics, he was bored with churning out generic stories filled with cardboard characters. So when Lee was instructed to create a team of superheroes that could challenge rival DC Comics' New Justice League of America, he saw the chance to push the format's limits. Together with artist Jack Kirby, Lee dreamed up the Fantastic Four. Mr. Fantastic, the Invisible Woman, the Human Torch, and the Thing. Unlike the bland, perfect Superman, the Fantastic Four were very human. They squabbled and struggled with self-doubt and angst. I tried to make them real flesh-and-blood characters, said Lee, which should not be considered radical. The comic was a hit. Marvel circulation nearly doubled to 13 million in a year. And in 1962, Lee introduced his defining hero, the neurotic, wisecracking Spider-Man. As editor and later publisher of Marvel, Lee was superhumanly productive, helping create Black Panther, The Incredible Hulk, The X-Men, and The Mighty Thor. The Marvel Universe now offers bottomless material for Disney blockbusters, and while Lee wasn't involved in movie production, he delighted in his creation's ubiquity. If I may be totally candid, he wrote, I'm my biggest fan. Stanley Lieber was born in New York City to Romanian Jewish immigrants, his father a dress cutter who was frequently out of work, said the Washington Post. After high school, he took a job at his cousin-in-law's Timely Publications, which published Marvel and was home to Captain America. Lee earned $8 a week running errands, but was soon thinking up stories. He went by several pseudonyms, and Stan Lee stuck. After serving stateside during World War II, Lee returned to Timely just as the so-called Golden Age of comics was coming to an end. Under pressure from politicians who claimed comics promoted juvenile delinquency, the industry imposed a draconian self-censorship code in 1954. Graphic gore and moral ambiguity were out, but so largely were wit, literary influences, and attention to social issues, said the New York Times. Readers found the sanitized comics boring, and within a few years, annual sales dropped by 3/4, from a high of $600 million. Lee was on the verge of quitting the industry in 1961 when his wife pushed him to shake things up with the Fantastic Four. Re-energized, he wrote up to 5 comic books a week and helped devise a string of other memorable but flawed superheroes, said the Times. Iron Man was a billionaire industrialist with a piece of shrapnel dangerously close to his heart. The Hulk couldn't control the anger that gave him his strength. Daredevil's blindness boosted his other senses, but many of Lee's Marvel's collaborators thought they weren't given sufficient credit for their work. Steve Ditko, who co-created Spider-Man, quit Marvel in 1966. Kirby defected to DC in 1970. Lee became Marvel's publisher in 1972 and spoke directly to fans in columns and letter pages with an enthusiastic, personable voice, said the Wall Street Journal. His missives concluded with trademark sign-offs, "Nuff said," and "Excelsior." Lee moved to Hollywood in 1980 to develop Marvel TV shows and movies, but found little success outside the CBS series The Incredible Hulk. He spent much of the past 2 decades on business ventures outside Marvel, owned by Disney since 2009, and had no involvement in the wave of Marvel-based movies that began with 2000's X-Men, save for cameos that fans came to love. Lee played a mailman in 2005's Fantastic Four, a Hugh Hefner lookalike in 2008's Iron Man, and a strip club DJ in 2016's Deadpool. He remained fiercely prolific, churning out new characters and story concepts into his 90s. "I want to do more of everything I'm doing," Lee said in 2010. "The only problem is time. I just wish there was more time." And we're on the Talking Points page now. We'll take an article called "The Midterms: Should Democrats Be Celebrating?" Democrats were gloomy as the first midterm election results began trickling in last week, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. As progressive favorites like gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum in Florida and Senate candidate Beto O'Rourke in Texas stumbled, it seemed as though the much-anticipated blue wave had shrunk to a blue trickle. But now that the dust has settled, it's clear that Democrats enjoyed a historic night. The party regained control of the House of Representatives by flipping at least 32 seats. With a handful of races still undecided, Democrats are on track to win more House seats than in any midterm since Watergate. Democrats also turned at least 333 seats in state legislatures from red to blue. Republicans did oust at least 3 incumbent Senate Democrats, but Democrats flipped seats in Nevada and Arizona, where Kyrsten Sinema won an open seat of retiring GOP Senator Jeff Flake. It took a while for the conventional wisdom of the American political class, accustomed to treating Democrats as hapless and disorganized, to catch up. But the blue wave was real, as Republicans paid a steep price for their embrace of the toxic President Trump. "Sure, the Democratic Party as a whole had a good night," said Michael Brendan Daugherty in NationalReview.com. "But make no mistake, progressives lost. Gillum, O'Rourke, and Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams ran unapologetic left-wing campaigns that progressives hoped would provide a template going forward. They all came up short. In the House, Kara Eastman in Nebraska and Scott Wallace in Pennsylvania campaigned on Medicare for All and lost winnable seats. Swing voters might not like the Republican agenda, but that's not a signal they're ready for ambitious social democratic reform either. That's why Democrats shouldn't kid themselves," said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. "The 30-plus seat swing that gave Democrats control of the House is nothing compared with Republicans' 63-seat landslide during the Obama backlash of 2010. Yet even that pounding did nothing to help Mitt Romney's chances 2 years later. Unless Democrats tack to the center, Trump is the odds-on favorite to win in 2020. That's a strange conclusion to reach, said Zach Bocamp in Box.com. Overall, Democrats won more votes than Republicans did in the GOP elections of 2010 and 1994. The unapologetically progressive Gillum, O'Rourke, and Abrams also fared better in red states than moderate Senate Democrats who lost their seats, such as Missouri's Claire McCaskill, Indiana's Joe Donnelly, and North Dakota's Heidi Heitkamp. Meanwhile, in Ohio, outspoken pro-labor Senator Sherrod Brown easily cruised to re-election. If progressivism were such an albatross, Brown would have lost in a state that looks more and more Republican by the year. And we'll skip on to a shorter note to finish up. The average wedding in the U.S. now has 5 bridesmaids, up from 4 in 2007. Between travel expenses, dresses, and hair and makeup, a bridesmaid can expect to spend $1,200 per wedding. And we'll finish out with a quote. This comes from Mary Shelley, quoted in investors.com. Invention, it must be humbly admitted, does not consist in creating out of void, but out of chaos. With that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.